This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Koslansky.
And we're your host for Art Moves. Today we'll be talking to Sean Leonardo, Eli. I think this guy is gone. This artist is on the rise. He is everywhere. I'm so delighted that we're going to get a chance to speak to Sean Leonardo. Welcome, Sean.
Very much appreciated. Happy to be here.
Excellent. So talk to us a little bit about who you are and your art. Like, how did you arrive as an artist? Just to give you a little breadcrumb. I know you were a football player at some time ago.
That's right.
So if you can talk to us about your transition.
I think that's the proper start. I played American football for 11 years of my life, starting at the age of 11 and going through a college career. And I think why it's appropriate is because content-wise, much of my early, certainly performance practice, all engaged what we would codify as, you know, these very hyper-masculine archetypes that really set us up for failure in regards to an ideal that we hold up against how we learn to be a man in American society. Now, the contradiction or the complexity of my own situation is that I dedicated so much of my life and my time to a tradition like American football that it often would surpass or even diminish my identity as an artist. And it wasn't until I started engaging the difficult contexts and questions of what it meant to be a man through my artistic practice that I learned how to more fully be in this world.
What do you mean, what it meant to be a man through your artistic practice?
And so much of my work, I would say, in the full trajectory of my practice, has always pointed to the uncomfortable questions of how we define masculinity in this country. And that has moved and has been reshaped and has looked a number of different ways. But at the core, what I offer and therefore ask others to discover is how we contain masculinity into a very rigid identity. One that does not allow for vulnerability, one that does not allow for an expression of weakness, and therefore sets one up to always look for an unattainable ideal, one in which being a man is equated with being a rock, being solid, always being unshakable. And ultimately, if we don't honor the complexity of our existence, our being in the world, what often manifests is the negative aspects of being a man, the aggression, the violence.
That's interesting. Yeah, but it's interesting that, you know, that people, the myth of it is that people equate vulnerability with weakness or surrender with weakness, right? Because you can surrender with an idea or surrender to a situation. I think it's also what's interesting about what you're saying, this idea about experience of failure. And it's a funny thing in America that you're not supposed, you know, part of this mystique is that you're not supposed to fail. But failure is where you get experience, you know, failure is where you get knowledge.
Yeah, the myth of the individual and the myth of the meritocracy and the way in which someone is supposed to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. I mean, that's a very American narrative. And I think when I hear you describe this sense of always chasing success, you know, I often ask and therefore invite others to think about, like, what is that as a definition of, let's say, individualism, progress, success, these words that we often hold up as American ideals, what is that not allowing for?
Yeah, that's interesting, right?
Right, you know, what is the opposite of that? What is it? And quite honestly, what I think about is the ways in which we diminish our sense of humanity and the complexity of our human experience. And so much, and this is jumping ahead, but so much of what I do in the context of my practice now and in the, with the young men that I work with in the nature of the criminal justice system is introduce the complexity of how we see ourselves. Because so often we are allowing the definitions that have been imposed on our bodies
we're
and psyches
wearing ourselves
to
and not
dictate
being ourselves.
How we move in
right,
the world.
Right, right.
It's also external. Right. It's
yeah,
also external
it's the
validation.
Wearing. It's yeah. like wearing the suit, as opposed to knowing who you are in the suit, kind of a thing.
But it's also yeah. a suit that you're being assigned.
Exactly. But
it's not just you pick it off the rack.
Exactly. But, you know, I'm thinking about this. I'm still with this football piece, and I look at it as a hyper-masculine sport, right? And to find yourself, was there a moment of confusion? Meaning, I'm just trying to figure out how football artists, you know, it's like antithesis.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I would say in my college career, I lived a dual life. Mm-hmm. There was a Sean Leonardo that existed in the field, in the locker room, and then there was a completely different identity as I existed in the studio. Different sets of behaviors, different sets of friends. And it wasn't until I found a way to marry those two in my own practice that I could discover a fuller self and all the inherent contradictions within. And I think part of what I try to explore and convey in my practice is that life is all of that messiness.
That's where it is. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I feel like I should give you, give us five on that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a lot to unpack here. So I'm trying to scratch my head and say, huh, but we'll sure should go with this. But I was also thinking that at one point, did you have an epiphany that says, oh, I can merge these two?
Like, no, it was gradual.
It was gradual.
It was gradual. And, right. you know, I'll give you one instance in which it really started to congeal or make sense to me. It was actually during my grad school experience when I went to a residency. Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture, where I actually now serve as a board member. And it was during that time where I was manifesting these same inquiries, these same questions around masculinities and definitions of manhood, but specifically in two-dimensional work, in painting. Mm-hmm. And the artists around me at the time kept pushing me, compelling me to embody that same work because I could enact it through my physical body. I still had the athleticism present and therefore the ability to manifest that same work through performative gestures. And it was that time, it was during that residency where I showed up during a lunch period with a Mexican wrestling mask on and fought an invisible presence.
Yeah, I've seen that. I find that so intriguing. How did people respond to that? Did they understand what you were doing?
I think the understanding was certainly there, but what attracted me to that type of expression was the immediacy, the spontaneity, the energetic exchange, the catharsis that was being experienced collectively with everyone, and how the audience, the public, was therefore intrinsic to the work. And I never looked back.
You speak of catharsis, though. So how did you know that the audience was experiencing that? By what they said? Meaning, is that what you were trying to achieve, that folks felt a catharsis?
There was a fever that's indescribable. Mm. And in that particular body of work, and certainly that early physical performance work, I was almost looking for a spiritual transcendence.
I'm hearing it. That's what I am picking that up.
And so much of what I was experiencing in the moment, because for me as the performer, particularly as the sole protagonist, manifesting this both metaphorical and literal struggle with obsolescence, with obscurity, with invisibility, what was bringing me back to that work was the way in which, almost in a ritualistic fashion, folks were submitting themselves over to this act.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking with Sean Leonardo. Yeah, and Sean, if you could just pick up on that catharsis piece, I think that's where we left off, how you said that there was a fever that you were able to feel in the audience. Is there anything more you want to say about that?
Well, I'll leave you with one particular moment in that performance piece, and certainly it manifested itself differently in other works. But at the end of the Invisible Man match, I was always certain to unmask myself in defeat. Now, in regards to the culture of lucha libre, that was incredibly potent because that would signify the end of that person's career. Once you were demasked, your identity was quite literally lost. But in the scope of this performative act, and then therefore this ritualistic exchange with the audience, what I was leaving folks with, in essence, in importance, was the fact that this was a human being that felt the need to struggle with oneself, the perception of oneself, and all of the contradictions, complexities that we metaphorically wrestle with when learning to define ourselves and carve out some kind of identity in this world. And that is a process. That is not a one-time thing, something that continuously
evolves. I think it's a way of being, quite honestly. Is it not? Is it not a way of being to be able to unpack yourself, look at those parts of yourself that are wounded, and lift them up to your consciousness so that you're able to just function even more successfully as a human being?
It's also an act of courage, too, because not everybody can do that.
I know. I don't understand why everybody can't do that.
Well, think about
it. It's like, well, you know what? I'll tell you why. Yeah. Jackie Mason once said he didn't want to go to a psychiatrist because what happens if he found out who he really was and didn't like who that was? So it's like, it's a little bit like that.
I hear you.
No, but it's like, you know, you really have to sort of be honest with yourself.
That's
and be
right.
Present to what your actions and who you are and your way of being in the world. And that's like, that could be really confronting. First of all, I love the work. I think the work's amazing.
Your work
Thank you.
Tremendous.
I love it.
I'm getting ready to ask other questions, but I want him to, he has some good stuff here.
Good stuff. Yeah, let me get it out of the bag. No, but so when I look at the stuff, the person that comes to mind, and you probably know who this is, George Bellows, right from the Ashcan School. The reason one is because he also has done these beautiful lithographs of sports, but he also has a social consciousness and activism, right?
In particular,
there is one painting called Return of the Useless. I don't know if you've heard that.
Not sure.
It was one of his seminal works, and it was about the Belgian prisoners, who the Germans used for slave labor, brought them back to Belgium to return them, which is kind of like, like a soda bottle or something, I don't know what. Mm. Of course, 20 years forward, they probably wouldn't be alive. But is that one of your influences or the early influence?
Is.
Must be, right?
It absolutely is. Certainly there are other influences, but just to stay with George Bellows for a moment, there's one painting that I'm visualizing for myself right now, which is of I think it's Joe Louis. Which was highly influential to us, particularly the drawing and painting that I was making, some years ago. And, I'm bringing this particular piece up because the orchestration of violence is only the surface level understanding of that work. When you really peer into it, there are two things that happen to me, which I try to echo in my own two-dimensional practice. One is you're seeing the sheer amount of emotionality present in those bodies, that the violence is really just the first filter in which we can look at this moment, that's just the capacity of those two bodies, one knocking out the other, to enact the fullness of human experience. I see terror in those bodies. I see fear. I see anxiety. I see it all. But equally important is in the audience. All of the spectators complete that narrative.
Interesting, right?
Mm-hmm. And you'll see in many of my drawings, in particular, I remove the main subjects so that we more intentionally look at who's watching. So we watch the watchers.
Wow. I want to talk about I Can't Breathe.
Sure.
If you can just talk to us about we know where it originated, but, mm-hmm. you know, the process you went through, who you were speaking to, how you were speaking.
No, I think that is also the logical piece to continue with in our discussion. There was a direct pivot in response to his murder, which, gosh, I guess it's almost 10 years now.
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. But, but given that so much of my work has centered hyper-masculinity and its ritual enactment of violence and aggression, almost as a rites of passage to earning manhood, much of what I was exploring at that time felt almost hypocritical if I were not to explore or directly respond to the ways in which Eric Garner's very existence, the ways in which those officers perceived his body to be in direct correlation to how he was killed. And so there were two things happening for me, therefore. One, I needed to talk about those definitions of Black masculinities in regards to law enforcement and how they directly lead to our deaths, and the ways in which I was looking at that video footage differently than other people that I knew in my own community, because I was looking at the chokehold for ways in which he might have been able to defend himself. I was looking at it through the filter of a fighter. And so what I would then therefore do, or what emerged as a performance piece, was that I would invite participants into what they believed to be a self-defense course. And what they would learn over the course of 30, 45 minutes would be actual self-defense techniques. They would be paired off with complete strangers, however. And as they were enacting these maneuvers, I would direct them, instruct them, based on, or I would say, it would start to be addressed within the context of police violence. And so what it would culminate with is really the impossibility of escaping that chokehold. And therefore, the inherent risk in defending oneself. So there, therefore, the dichotomy or the sort of what's the word I'm looking for?
Paradox.
Paradox. The paradox of self-defense.
Yeah. Right.
That for certain bodies,
because it could be perceived as
it
resistance.
It brings more
right?
damage because it is perceived
that's the challenge
as resistance.
There's no question you could probably learn how to defend yourself, but would that in the situation be perceived as a threat?
Exactly.
So yeah, it's paradoxical.
I'm wondering though, you know, how are you using art as a bridge to help males, especially those who have been incarcerated, to embrace their total, to embrace masculinity under a new paradigm where vulnerability is something that, you know, and, you know, vulnerability can be an issue for women, too, meaning it's not just men that struggle with that.
Absolutely.
You know, but so how do you connect the art in such a way that it is accessible and something that a population of people that have been incarcerated mm-hmm. can appreciate?
Yeah. Quite often what that requires is removing the word art entirely.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And so I'll be specific to my current practice. I've had the honor and privilege of co-founding and therefore creating and moving through a practice of diversion starting 7 years ago, a program entitled Assembly, which was co-founded between myself and my now co-director, Allison Weisberg, at the nonprofit Recess, which is very close by to where we are. And it is specifically an intervention in the court system. And so young folks who have been incarcerated but face open charges rather than have their cases pursued in court come to Recess, and after a 4-week cycle or 10-week cycle, depending on the degree of charge, can have their cases closed and their records sealed. Now, to answer your question, what continues to drive the work are the ways in which these young folks, which now is not predominantly men, it's both men and women, because the rising rates of incarceration amongst young women is real. and let me be even more specific to Black and brown young people. But what continues to drive the work are the ways in which they are already describing oneself as criminal. And so they are using the language that has been imposed on their psyche, on their bodies, as a definition of who they are. Now, I always say, therefore, to legislators, what policy change, what legislation is ever going to take effect if those that you are speaking about already believe that there are no other options for them?
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. And we're talking with Sean Leonardo. And Sean, if you can just pick up where we left off.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. And so my work, our work, because there are a number of educators that have been brought into the fold and now enact the assembly curriculum, is invested in the possibility of looking at our narratives and specifically these experiences of arrest and incarceration, not through verbal telling, but through how they flow through one's body and therefore is conveyed through body language. The argument being that there's a different kind of truth that is unveiled when a story is told with a person's body. And that truth is in direct opposition to the ways in which a young person is defining themselves as criminal. What you find in that space of wordless articulation is a story about a human being, that has had to struggle through so many circumstances that go well beyond someone's own personal decision making. What you see is how criminalization begins at an early age in the streets, at home, at school. And so when you mentioned this idea of how we confront these definitions, right? Really what this work is dedicated to is showing a young person how it is that they do not have to be defined by that experience. And once you grab a hold onto your own story on your own terms and tell it with your own agency, you start to see options for yourself. You start to see possibility differently.
What is Recess Art? Where is it located? What is your mission? And
well, I appreciate that because as my relationship with Recess begins with the assembly program, which I've been describing, but really, and actually what I've been describing to you is more of a methodology and a practice than a program. I hesitate to even use the word program, but I'm fortunate enough to now, for the last year, have been welcomed in as co-director. So my role at Recess, which is a Brooklyn-based arts-based nonprofit, very close by to where we are, 46 Washington Avenue, I've been asked to be co-director for the last year to look at the entire organization through the lens of my practice. And what's unique about Recess, well, there are a number of things, but I'll mention two. One is that it is invested in process over product and output. And so for the assembly program, as I've been describing it, any young person that moves through the court-mandated cycle is welcomed to continue their engagement with us through paid long-term roles.
How do they find out about this program?
So we do have now a referral side of the program, but they're still being mandated by the courts, whether through felony or misdemeanor charges.
And mandated?
By the court system.
To go to Recess?
That's right.
Oh, really?
That's right. Wow. Those are the sort of nuts and bolts of diversion as it exists. And so what we hope is that we can take what is otherwise an awful episode of their lives and move it toward an opportunity.
I'd like to talk. You said something about paid long-term roles. Let's talk about what those roles are, because I'm sure there'll be people that are listening that are also going to want to hear you as a resource.
That's great. That's great. So our young folks self-select to stay on. And that continued work and engagement, it looks like a number of different ways. always as defined by their interests. And so a young person is oftentimes an apprentice to one of our artists. Oftentimes they're co-facilitating future workshops alongside myself or other practitioners. Sometimes they take a mentorship role. Others are building their own portfolios. We have a print shop facility on site. What's most important is that they become integral to Recess as part of an ecosystem of activity and action that is happening on site. Our artists' projects are also 8 to 9 weeks long and are dedicated to process and the ways in which community engagement are intrinsic to these processes. And so we forego the pressure of having to come up with a fixed exhibition, for example, and instead are inviting artists to really enmesh themselves in community and the critical questions and dialogues that they feel are necessary into building that community. So as these programs, and I hate to use those words, but that's what's the, overlap, what we really are fostering is a sense of belonging within this physical place, a place where artists, young people, our board members, our staff members can come and develop a site that engages the way of being and the way of expression that we cannot find outside of our walls.
So in a lot of ways, you're also building, not just building a community, but you're building a community of enduring relationships.
And resilience.
Resilience, yeah.
I like to call it world-making almost.
World-making.
Well,
yeah,
there's something that you said on your website, we believe in centering marginalized voices while insisting that everyone should shoulder the work of dismantling divisive and oppressive systems. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
20 words or less.
We pride ourselves in being an operation that directly, actively and outspokenly works against the nonprofit industry and the ways and mechanics of the art world.
Interesting.
And so while other opportunities for artists are commercially driven and therefore extractive in nature, always requiring production, always requiring output to serve the market, and while other institutions, I'm talking diplomatically and broadly, while other institutions would connote community building or community programs as something that a community is invited into and then has to leave, what we are arguing for is that these critical questions that we need to ask, and therefore the ways in which we build a sense of belonging around these issues, involves a place where everyone has a seat at the table, and therefore
so it's
shares in the
leadership.
Power.
Right.
That's right.
It's also
wow.
circular too. It's like it's
right.
not just inside out, outside in. It's a network, if you will.
That's right. And we use the language of network for sure.
Yeah. I think this man has vision. So thank you. Right? Just scratch.
We're on page 1 of 5 pages here.
Exactly. I mean, just the way you speak, again, what a storyteller. You are so brilliant.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you for giving me the time and space.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kuzlansky. Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.